Track 10.
Warlock was racing into the chop of the Gulf Stream and scattering the spray like startled white doves. But she was running too slowly for Nicholas, and he turned away impatiently and strode into the navigation bridge. David Allen looked up at him, a small frown of preoccupation marring the smooth, boyish features. "The wind is moderating and veering westerly," he said. And Nicholas remembered another line of doggerel. "When the wind moves against the sun, trust her not, for back she'll run." He did not recite it, however. He merely nodded and said, "We're running into the extreme influence of Lorna. The wind will back again as we move closer to the center." Nicholas went on to the radio room, and the trog looked up at him. It was not necessary for Nicholas to ask. The trog shook his head. Since that long exchange with the Coast Guard patrol early that morning, Golden Dawn had kept her silence. Nicholas crossed the radar scope and studied the circular field for a few minutes. This usually busy seaway was peculiarly empty. There were some small craft crossing the main channel, probably fishing boats or pleasure craft, scuttling for protection from the coming storm. All across the islands and on the mainland of Florida, the elaborate precautions against the hurricane assault would be coming into force. Since the highway had been laid down on the spur of the little islands that formed the Florida Keys, more than 300,000 people had crowded in there, in the process transforming those wild, lovely islands into the Taj Mahal of Tiki-Taki. If the hurricane struck there, the loss of life and property would be enormous. It was probably the most vulnerable spot on a long, exposed coastline. For a few minutes, Nicholas tried to imagine the chaos that would result if a million tons of toxic crude oil was driven ashore on a littoral already ravaged by hurricane wind. It balked his imagination, and he left the radar and moved to the front of the bridge. He stood staring down the narrow throat of water at a horizon that concealed all the terrors and desperate alarms that his imagination could conjure up. The door to the radio shack was open, and the bridge was quiet, so that they all heard it clearly. They could even catch the hiss of breath as the speaker paused between each sentence, and the urgency of his tone was not covered by the slight distortion of the VHF carrier beam. "Mayday! Mayday! Mayday! This is the bulk oil carrier Golden Dawn. Our position is 79 degrees 50 west, 25 degrees 43 north." Before Nicholas reached the chart table, he knew she was still 100 miles ahead of them. And as he pored over the table, he saw his estimate confirmed. "We have lost our propeller with main shaft failure, and we are drifting out of control." Nicholas's head flinched, as though he'd been hit in the face. He could imagine no more dangerous condition and position for a ship of that size. And Peter was on board. "This is Golden Dawn, calling the United States Coast Guard Service or any ship in a position to afford assistance." Nicholas reached the radio shack with three long strides, and the trog handed in the microphone and nodded. "Golden Dawn, this is the salvage tug Warlock. I will be in a position to render assistance within 4 hours." Damn the rule of silence. Peter was on board her. "Tell Alexander I'm offering Lloyd's open form, and I want immediate acceptance." He dropped the microphone and stormed back onto the bridge, his voice clipped and harsh as he caught David Allen's arm. "Interception course, and push her through the gate," he ordered grimly. "Tell Beauty Baker to open all the taps." He dropped David's arm and spun back to the radio room. "Tell Ex Le Voisin on Sea Witch. I want him to give me a time to reach Golden Dawn at his best possible speed." And he wondered briefly if even the two tugs would be able to control the crippled and powerless Golden Dawn in the winds of a hurricane. Jules replied almost immediately. He had bunkered at Charleston and cleared harbor 6 hours previously. He was running hard now, and he gave a time to Golden Dawn's position for noon the next day, which was also the forecast time of passage of the straits for Hurricane Lorna, according to the meteorological update they'd got from Miami 2 hours before. Nicholas thought as he read the telex and turned to David Allen. David, there's no precedent for this that I know of. But with my son on board Golden Dawn, I just have to assume command of this ship, on a temporary basis, of course. I'd be honored to act as your first officer again, sir, David told him quietly. And Nicholas could see he meant it. If there's good salvage, the master's share will still be yours, Nicholas promised him, and thanked him with a touch on the arm. Would you check out the preparations to put a line aboard the tanker? David turned to leave the bridge, but Nicholas stopped him. By the time we get there, we'll have the kind of wind you have only dreamed about in your worst nightmares. Just keep that in mind. Telex, screeched the Trog. Golden Dawn is replying to our offer. Nicholas strode across to the radio room and read the first few lines of messages it printed out. Offer contract of daily hire for towage this vessel from present position to Galveston Roads. The bastard, Nicholas snarled. He's playing his fancy games with me in the teeth of a hurricane and with my boy aboard. Furiously, he punched his fist into the palm of his other hand. Right, he snapped. We'll play just as rough. Get me the headquarters of the U.S. Coast Guard at the Fort Lauderdale headquarters. Get him on the emergency Coast Guard frequency and I'll talk to him in clear. The Trog's face lit with malicious glee and he made the contact. Colonel Ramsden, Nicholas said. This is the Master of Warlock. I'm the only salvage vessel that can reach Golden Dawn before passage of Lorna. And I'm probably the only tug on the eastern seaboard of America with 22,000 horsepower. Unless the Golden Dawn's master accepts Lloyd's open form within the next 60 minutes, I shall be obliged to see to the safety of my vessel and crew by running for the nearest anchorage. And you're going to have 1 million tons of highly toxic crude oil drifting out of control in your territorial waters in hurricane conditions. The Coast Guard director had a deep, measured voice, and the calm tones of a man upon whom the mantle of authority was a familiar garment. Stand by, Warlock. I'm going to contact Golden Dawn direct on Channel 16. Nicholas signaled the Trog to turn up the volume on Channel 16, and they listened to Ramsden speaking directly to Duncan Alexander. In the event your vessel enters United States territorial waters without control, or without an attendant tug capable of exerting that control, I shall be obliged, under the powers vested in me, to seize your vessel and take such steps to prevent pollution of our waters as I see fit. I have to warn you that those steps may include destruction of your cargo. 10 minutes later, the Trog copied a telex from Duncan Alexander personal to Nicholas Berg, accepting Lloyd's open form and requesting him to exercise all dispatch in taking Golden Dawn in tow. I estimate we'll be drifting over the 100-fathom line and entering U.S. territorial waters within 2 hours, the message ended. While Nicholas read it, standing out on the protected wing of Warlock's Bridge, the wind suddenly fluttered the paper in his hand and flattened his cotton shirt against his chest. He looked up quickly and saw the wind was backing violently into the east and beginning to claw the tops of the Gulf Stream swells. The setting sun was bleeding copiously across the high veils of cirrus cloud, which now covered the sky from horizon to horizon. There was nothing more that Nicholas could do now. Warlock was running as hard as she could, and all her crew were quietly going about their preparations to pass a wire and take on tow. All he could do was wait, but that was always the hardest part. Darkness came swiftly, but with the last of the light, Nicholas could just make out a dark and mountainous shape beginning to hump up above the southern horizon like an impatient monster. He stared at it with awful fascination, until mercifully the night hid Lorna's dreadful face. The wind chopped the Gulf Stream into quick, confused seas, and it did not blow steadily, but flogged them with squally gusts and rain that crackled against the bridge windows with startling suddenness. The night was utterly black. There were no stars, no source of light whatsoever, and Warlock lurched and heeled to the patternless seas. Barometer's rising sharply, David Allen called suddenly. It's jumped 3 millibars, back to 1,005. The trough, said Nicholas grimly. It was a classic hurricane formation, that narrow girdle of higher pressure that demarcated the outer fringe of the great revolving spiral of tormented air. We're going into it now. And as he spoke, the darkness lifted. The heavens began to burn like a bed of hot coals, and the sea shone with a sullen, ruddy luminosity, as though the doors of a furnace had been thrown wide. Nobody spoke on Warlock's Bridge. They lifted their faces with the same awed expressions as worshippers in a lofty cathedral, and they looked up at the skies. No cloud raced above them, cloud that glowed and shone with that terrible, ominous flare. Slowly, the light faded and changed, turning a paler, sickly, greenish hue, like the shine on putrid meat. Nicholas spoke first. The Devil's Beacon, he said, and he wanted to rationalize it, to break the superstitious mood that gripped them all. It was merely the rays of the sun below the western horizon, catching the cloud peaks of the storm, and reflected downwards through the weak cloud cover of the trough. But somehow, he could not find the right words to denigrate that phenomenon that was part of the mariner's lore, the malignant beacon that leads a doomed ship onto its fate. The weird light faded slowly away, leaving the night even darker and more foreboding than it had been before. David, Nicholas thought quickly of something to distract his officers. Have we got a radar contact yet? And the new mate roused himself with visible effort and crossed to the radar scope. The range is very confused, he said, his voice still subdued, and Nicholas joined him at the screen. The sweeping arm lit a swirling mass of sea clutter, and the strange ghost echoes thrown up by electrical discharges within the approaching storm. The outline of the Florida mainland and of the nearest islands of the Grand Bahamas were firm and immediately recognizable. They reminded Nicholas yet again of how little sea room there was in which to maneuver his tugs and their monstrous prize. Then, in the trash of false echo and sea clutter, his trained eye picked out a harder echo on the extreme limits of the set's range. He watched it carefully for half a dozen revolutions of the radar sweep, and each time it was constant and clearer. Radar contact, he said. Tell Golden Dawn we are in contact. Range, 65 nautical miles. Tell them we will take on tow before midnight. And then under his breath, the old sailor's qualifications, God willing and weather permitting. The lights on Warlock's Bridge had been rheostated down to a dull rose glow to protect the night vision of her officers, and the four of them stared out to where they knew the Tanger lay. Her image on the radar was bright and firm, lying within the 2-mile ring of the screen, but from the bridge she was invisible. In the 2 hours since first contact, the barometer had gone through its brief peak as the trough passed and then fallen steeply. From 1,005 it had crashed to 990 and was still plummeting, and the weather coming in from the east was blustering and squalling. The wind mourned about them on a forever rising note, and torrential rain obscured all vision outside an arc of a few hundred yards. Even Warlock's twin searchlights, set 70 feet above the main deck on the summit of the fire control gantry, could not pierce those solid white curtains of rain. Nicholas groped like a blind man through the rain fog, using pitch and power to close carefully with Golden Dawn, giving his orders to the helm in a cool, impersonal tone, which belied the pale set of his features and the alert brightness of his eyes as he searched the swirling bank of rain. Abruptly, another squall struck Warlock. With a demented shriek, it heeled the big tug sharply and shredded the curtains of rain, ripping them open so that for a moment Nicholas saw Golden Dawn. She was exactly where he'd expected her to be. The wind had caught the tanker's high navigation bridge like the mainsail of a tall ship, and she was going swiftly astern. All her deck and port lights were burning, and she carried the twin red riding lights at her stubby masthead that identified a vessel drifting out of control. The following sea, driven on by the rising wind, piled onto her tank decks, smothering them with white foam and spray, so that the ship looked like a submerged coral reef. "Half ahead both," Nicholas told the helmsman. "Steer for her starboard side." He closed quickly with the tanker, staying in visual contact now. Even when the rain mists closed down again, they could make out the ghostly shape of her and the glow of her riding lights. David Allen was looking at him expectantly, and Nicholas asked, "What bottom?" without taking his eyes from the stricken ship. 116 fathoms and shelving fast. They were being blown quickly out of the main channel onto the shallow ledge of the Florida littoral. "I'm going to tow her out stern first," said Nicholas. And immediately David saw the wisdom of it. Nobody would be able to get her into the bows to secure a tow line. The seas were breaking over them and sweeping them with 10 and 15 feet of green water. "I'll go aft," David began, but Nicholas stopped him. "No, David, I want you here, because I'm going on board Golden Dawn." "Sir." David wanted to tell him that it was dangerous to delay passing the towing cable, with that lee shore waiting. "This'll be our last chance to get passengers off her before the full hurricane hits us," said Nicholas. And David saw that it was futile to protest. Nicholas Berg was going to fetch his son. From the height of Golden Dawn's towering navigation bridge, they could look directly down onto the main deck of the tug as she came alongside. Peter Berg stood beside his mother, almost as tall as she was. He wore a full life jacket and a corduroy cap pulled down over his ears. "It'll be all right," he comforted Chantel. "Dad is here. It'll be just fine now." And he took her hand protectively. Warlock staggered and reeled in the grip of the wind as she came up into the tanker's lee. Rain blew over her like dense white smoke, and every few minutes she put her nose down and threw a thick green slice of seawater back along her decks. In comparison to the tug's wild action, Golden Dawn wallowed heavily, held down by the oppressive weight of 1 million tons of crude oil, and the seas beat upon her with increasing fury, as if affronted by her indifference. Warlock edged in closer, and still closer. Duncan Alexander came through from the communications room at the rear of the bridge. He balanced easily against Golden Dawn's ponderous motion, but his face was swollen and flushed with anger. Berg is coming on board, he burst out. He's wasting valuable time. I warned him that we must get out into deeper water. Peter Berg interrupted suddenly and pointed down at Warlock. Look, he cried. Until that moment, the night and the storm had hidden the small huddle of human shapes in the tug's high forehead tower. They wore wet, glistening oilskins, and their life jackets gave them a swollen, pregnant look. They were lowering the boarding gantry into the horizontal position. There's Dad, Peter shouted. That's him in front. At the extremity of her roll, Warlock's boarding gantry touched the railing of the tanker's quarterdeck, 10 feet above the swamped tank deck. And the leading figure on the tug's upper works ran out lightly upon the gantry, balanced for a moment high above the roaring, racing green water, and then leapt across 5 feet of open space, caught a handhold, and then pulled himself up over Golden Dawn's rail. Immediately, the tug sheered off and fell in 50 yards off the tanker's starboard side, half hidden in the rain mists, but holding her station steadily, despite all the winds and the sea's spiteful efforts to separate the two vessels. The whole maneuver had been performed with an expertise which made it seem almost casual. Dad's carried a line across, Peter said proudly. And Chantel, looking down, saw that a delicate white nylon thread was being hove in by 2 seamen on the tanker's quarterdeck, while from the tug's fire control tower, a canvas bosun's chair was being winched across. The elevator doors slid open with a whine, and Nicholas Berg strode up onto the tanker's bridge. His oilskins still ran with rainwater that splattered onto the deck at his feet. Dad! Peter ran to meet him, and Nicholas stooped and embraced him fiercely before straightening. With one arm still about his son's shoulders, he confronted Chantel and Duncan Alexander. I hope both of you are satisfied now, he said quietly. But I, for one, don't rate our chances of saving this ship very highly. So I'm taking off everybody who is not needed on board to handle her. Your tug, burst out Duncan. You've got 22,000 horsepower, and you can... There's a hurricane on its way, said Nicholas coldly, and he shot a glance out at the roaring night. This is just the overture. He turned back to Randall. How many men do you want to keep on board? Randall thought a moment. Myself, a helmsman, and 5 seamen to handle the tow lines and work the ship. He paused and then went on, and the pump room personnel to control the cargo. You will act as helmsman. I will control the pump room. And I'll need only 3 seamen. Get me volunteers, Nicholas decided. Send everybody else off. Sir, Randall began to protest. May I remind you, Captain, that I am salvage master, and my authority now supersedes yours. Nicholas did not wait for his reply. Chantel, he picked her out. Take Peter down to the quarterdeck. You'll go across first. Listen here, Berg. Duncan could no longer contain himself. I insist you pass the towing cable. The ship is in danger. Get down there with them, Nicholas snapped. I'll decide the procedures. Do as he says, darling. Chantel smiled up at her husband vindictively. You've lost. Nicholas is the only winner now. Shut up, damn you, Duncan hissed at her. Get down to the afterdeck. Nicholas' voice cracked like breaking ice. I'm staying on board this ship, said Duncan abruptly. It's my responsibility. I said I'd see it out, and by God, I will. I'm going to be here to make sure you do your job, Berg. Nicholas checked himself and studied him for a long moment, and then smiled mirthlessly. Nobody ever called you a coward, he nodded reluctantly. Other things, but not a coward. Stay if you will. We might need an extra hand. Then to Peter, come, my boy. And he led him towards the elevator. At the quarter-deck rail, Nicholas hugged the boy, holding him in his arms, their cheeks pressed tightly together, and drawing out the moment while the wind cannoned and thrummed above their heads. I love you, Dad. I love you, Peter, more than I can ever tell you. But you must go now. He broke the embrace and lifted the child into the deep canvas bucket of the bosun's chair, stepped back, and windmilled his right arm. Immediately, the winch party in Warlock's upper works swung him swiftly out into the gap between the two ships, and the nylon cable seemed as fragile and insubstantial as a spider's thread. As the two ships rolled and dipped, so the line tightened and sagged, one moment dropping the white canvas bucket almost to water level, where the hungry waves snatched at it with cold green fangs, and the next pulling the line up so tightly that it hummed with tension, threatening to snap and drop the child back into the sea. But at last, it reached the tug, and four pairs of strong hands lifted the boy clear. For one moment, he waved back at Nicholas, and then he was hustled away, and the empty bosun's chair was coming back. Only then did Nicholas become aware that Chantelle was clinging to his arm, and he looked down into her face. Her eyelashes were dewed and stuck together with the flying raindrops. Her face ran with wetness, and she seemed very small and childlike under the bulky oilskins and life jacket. She was as beautiful as she'd ever been, but her eyes were huge and darkly troubled. "Nicholas, I've always needed you," she husked, "but never as I need you now." Her existence was being blown away on the wind, and she was afraid. "You and this ship are all I have left." "No, only the ship," he said brusquely, and he was amazed that the spell was broken. The soft area of his soul, which she'd been able to touch so unerringly, was now armored against her. With a sudden surge of relief, he realized he was free of her forever. It was over. Here in the storm, he was free at last. She sensed it, for the fear in her eyes changed to real terror. "Nicholas, you cannot desert me now. Oh, Nicholas, what will become of me without you and Christy Marine?" "I don't know," he told her quietly, and caught the bosun's chair as it came in over Golden Dawn's rail. He lifted her as easily as he'd lifted his son and placed her in the canvas bucket. "And to tell you the truth, Chantelle, I don't really care," he said, and stepping back, he windmilled his right arm. The chair swooped out across the narrow water, swinging like a pendulum in the wind. Chantelle shouted something at him, but Nicholas had turned away and was already going aft in a lurching run to where the three volunteers were waiting. He saw at a glance that they were big, powerful, competent-looking men. Quickly, Nicholas checked their equipment, from the thick leather gauntlets to the bolt cutters and jemmy bars for handling heavy cable. "You'll do," he said. "We'll use the bosun's tackle to bring across a messenger from the tug, just as soon as the last man leaves this ship." Working with men to whom the task was unfamiliar, and in rapidly deteriorating conditions of sea and weather, it took almost another hour before they had the main cable across from Warlock secured by its thick nylon spring to the tanker's stern bollards. Yet, the time had passed so swiftly for Nicholas that when he stood back and glanced at his watch, he was shocked. Before this wind, they must have been going down very fast onto the land. He staggered into the tanker's stern quarters and left a trail of seawater down the passageway to the elevators. On the bridge, Captain Randall was standing grim-faced at the helm, and Duncan Alexander snapped accusingly at him, "You've cut it damn fine." A single glance at the digital printout of the depth gauge on the tanker's control console bore him out. They had 38 fathoms of water under them now, and Golden Dawn's swollen belly sagged down 20 fathoms below the surface. They were going down very swiftly before the easterly gale winds. It was damned fine, Nicholas had to agree. But he showed no alarm or agitation as he crossed to Randall's side and unhooked the hand microphone. David, he asked quietly, are you ready to haul us off? Ready, sir. David Allen's voice came from the speaker above his head. I'm going to give you full port rudder to help your turn across the wind, said Nicholas, and then nodded to Randall. Full port rudder. 40 degrees of port rudder on, Randall reported. They felt the tiny shock as the tow cable came up taut, and carefully, Warlock began the delicate task of turning the huge ship across the rising, gusting wind, and then dragging her out tail first into the deeper water of the channel, where she would have her best chance of riding out the hurricane. It was clear now that Golden Dawn lay directly in the track of Lorna, and the storm unleashed its true nature upon them. Out there, upon the sane and rational world, the sun was rising. But here, there was no dawn, for there was no horizon and no sky. There was only madness and wind and water, and all three elements were so intermingled as to form one substance. An hour, which seemed like a lifetime ago. The wind had ripped away the anemometer and the wind recording equipment on top of the navigation bridge. So Nicholas had no way of judging the wind's strength and direction. Out beyond the bridge windows, the wind took the top off the sea. It took it off in thick sheets of salt water and lifted them over the navigation bridge in a shrieking white curtain that cut off visibility at the glass of the windows. The tank deck had disappeared in the racing white emulsion of wind and water. Even the railing of the bridge wings, 6 feet from the windows, was invisible. The entire superstructure groaned and popped and whimpered under the assault of the wind, the pressed aluminium bulkheads bulging and distorting, the very deck flexing and juddering at the solid weight of the storm. Through the saturated, racing, swirling air, a leaden and ominous grey light filtered, and every few minutes, the electrical impulses generated within the 60,000-foot-high mountain of racing, spinning air released themselves in shattering cannonades of thunder and sudden brilliance of eye-searing white lightning. There was no visual contact with Warlock. The massive electrical disturbance of the storm and the clutter of high seas, an almost solid cloud and turbulence, had reduced the radar range to a few miles, and even then it was unreliable. Radio contact with the tug was drowned with buzzing, squealing static. It was possible to understand only odd, disconnected words from David Allen. Nicholas was powerless, caged in the groaning, vibrating box of the navigation bridge, blinded and deafened by the unleashed powers of the heavens. There was nothing any of them could do. Randall had locked the ultra-tanker's helm amidships, and now he stood with Duncan and the three seamen by the chart table, all of them clinging to it for support, all their faces pale and set as though carved from chalk. Only Nicholas moved restlessly about the bridge. From the stern windows, where he peered down vainly, trying to get a glimpse of either the tow cable and its spring, or of the tug's looming shape through the racing white storm. Then he came forward carefully, using the foul weather rail to steady himself against the huge ship's wild and unpredictable motion. and he stood before the control console, studying the display of lights that monitored the pod tanks and the ship's navigational and mechanical functions. None of the petroleum tanks had lost any crude oil, and in all of them, the nature of the inert gas was constant. There had been no ingress of air to them. They were all still intact then. One of the reasons that Nicholas had taken the tanker in tow stern first was so that the navigation tower might break the worst of wind and sea, and the fragile, bloated tanks would receive some protection from it. Yet desperately, he wished for a momentary sight of the tank deck, merely to reassure himself. There could be malfunction in the pump control instruments. The storm could have clawed one of the pod tanks open. And even now, Golden Dawn could be bleeding her poison into the sea. But there was no view of the tank deck through the storm, and Nick stooped to the radar scope. The screen glowed and danced and flickered with ghost images and trash. He wasn't too certain if even Warlock's image was constant. The range seemed to be opening, as though the tow line had parted. He straightened up and stood balanced on the balls of his feet, to reassure himself by the feel of the deck that Golden Dawn was still under tow. He could feel by the way she resisted the wind and the sea that the tow was still good. Yet there was no means of telling their position. The satellite navigational system was completely blanketed. The radio waves were distorted and diverted by tens of thousands of feet of electrical storm. And the same force was blanketing the marine radio beacons on the American mainland. The only indication was the ship's electronic log, which gave Nicholas the speed of the ship's hull through the water, and the speed across the sea bottom, and the depth finder, which recorded the water under her keel. For the first 2 hours of the tow, Warlock had been able to pull the ship back towards the main channel at 3.5 knots, and slowly the water had become deeper, until they had 150 fathoms under them. Then, as the wind velocity increased, the windage of Golden Dawn's superstructure had acted as a vast mainsail, and the storm had taken control. Now, despite all the power in Warlock's big twin propellers, both tug and tanker were being pushed once more back towards the 100-fathom line and the American mainland. "Where is Sea Witch?" Nicholas wondered, and he stared helplessly at the gauges. They were going towards the shore at a little over 2 knots, and the bottom was shelving steeply. The Sea Witch might be the ace that took the trick if she could reach them through these murderous seas and savage winds, and if she could find them in this wilderness of mad air and water. Again, Nicholas groped his way to the communications room, and still clinging to the bulkhead with one hand, he thumbed the microphone. "Sea Witch, Sea Witch, this is Warlock, calling Sea Witch." He listened then, trying to tune out the snarl and crackle of static crouching over the set. Faintly he thought he heard a human voice, a scratchy whisper through the interference, and he called again and listened and called again. There was the voice again, but so indistinct he could not make out a single word. Above his head, there was a tearing screech of rending metal. Nicholas dropped the microphone and staggered through onto the bridge. There was another deafening banging and hammering, and all of them stood staring up at the metal roof of the bridge. It sagged and shook. There was one more crash. And then, with a scraping, dragging rush, a confused tangle of metal and wire and cable tumbled over the forward edge of the bridge and flapped and swung wildly in the wind. It took a moment for Nicholas to realize what it was. "The radar antennae," he shouted. He recognized the elongated dish of the aerial, dangling on a thick coil of cable. Then the wind tore that loose also, and the entire massive equipment flapped away like a giant bat and was instantly lost in the teeming white curtains of the storm. With two quick paces, he reached the radar scope, and one glance was enough. The screen was black and dead. They had lost their eyes now, and unbelievably, the sound of the storm was rising again. It boomed against the square box of the bridge, and the men within it cowered from its fury. Then abruptly, Duncan was screaming something at Nicholas and pointing up at the master display of the control console. Nicholas, still hanging on to the radar scope, roused himself with an effort and looked up at the display. The speed across the ground had changed drastically. It was now almost 8 knots, and the depth was 92 fathoms. Nicholas felt icy despair clutch and squeeze his guts. The ship was moving differently under him. He could feel her now in mortal distress. That same gust which had torn away the radar mast had done other damage. He knew what that damage was, and the thought of it made him want to vomit, but he had to make sure. He had to be absolutely certain, and he began to hand himself along the foul weather rail towards the elevator doors. Across the bridge, the others were watching him intently, but even from 20 feet, it was impossible to make himself heard above the clamorous assault of the storm. One of the seamen seemed suddenly to guess his intention. He left the chart table and groped his way along the bulkhead towards Nicholas. "Good man." Nicholas grabbed his arm to steady him, and they fell forward into the elevator as Golden Dawn began another of those ponderous, wallowing rolls, and the deck fell out from under their feet. The ride down in the elevator car slammed them back and forth across the little coffin-like box. And even here, in the depths of the ship, they had to shout to hear each other. "The tow cable!" Nicholas yelled in the man's ear. "Check the tow cable!" From the elevator, they went carefully aft along the central passageway. And when they reached the double storm doors, Nicholas tried to push the inner door open, but the pressure of the wind held it closed. "Help me!" he shouted at the seamen, and they threw their combined weight against it. The instant they forced the jam open a crack, the vacuum of pressure was released, and the wind took the 3-inch mahogany doors and ripped them effortlessly from their hinges and whisked them away, as though they were a pair of playing cards. And Nicholas and the seamen were exposed in the open doorway. The wind flung itself upon them and hurled them to the deck, smothering them in the icy deluge of water that ripped at their faces as abrasively as ground glass. Nicholas rolled down the deck and crashed into the stern rail with such jarring force that he thought his lungs had been crushed. And the wind pinned him there, and blinded and smothered him with salt water. He lay there helpless as a newborn infant, and near him he heard the seamen screaming thinly. The sound steeled him, and Nicholas slowly dragged himself to his knees, desperately clutching at the rail to resist the wind. Still the man screamed, and Nicholas began to creep forward on his hands and knees. It was impossible to stand in that wind, and he could move only with support from the rail. 6 feet ahead of him, the extreme limit of his vision, the railing had been torn away, a long section of it dangling over the ship's side, and to this was clinging the seaman. His weight, driven by the wind, must have hit the rail with sufficient force to tear it loose. And now he was hanging on with one arm hooked through the railing, and the other arm twisted from a shattered shoulder, and waving a crazy salute as the wind whipped it about. When he looked up at Nicholas, his mouth had been smashed in. It looked as though he had half-chewed a mouthful of black currants, and the jagged stumps of his broken front teeth were bright red with the juice. On his belly, Nicholas reached for him, and as he did so, the wind came again. Unbelievably, it was stronger still, and it took the damaged railing, with the man still upon it, and tore it bodily away. They disappeared instantly in the blinding whiteout of the storm, and Nicholas felt himself hurled forward towards the edge. He clung with all his strength to the remaining section of the rail, and felt it buckle and begin to give. On his knees, he clawed himself away from that fatal beckoning gap towards the stern, and the wind struck him full in the face, blinding and choking him. Sightlessly, he dragged himself on until one outstretched arm struck the cold cast iron of the port stern bollard, and he flung both arms about it like a lover, choking and retching from the salt water that the wind had forced through his nose and mouth and down his throat. Still blind, he felt for the woven steel of Warlock's main tow wire. He found it and could not span it with his fist, but he felt the quick lift of his hopes. The cable was still secured. He had catted and prevented it with a dozen nylon strops, and it was still holding. He crawled forward, dragging himself along the tow cable, and immediately he realized that his relief had been premature. There was no tension in the cable, and when he reached the edge of the deck, it dangled straight down. It was not stretched out into the whiteness, to where he had hoped the Warlock was still holding them like a great sea anchor. He knew then that what he had dreaded had happened. The storm had been too powerful. It had snapped the steel cable like a thread of cotton, and Golden Dawn was loose, without control, and this wild and savage wind was blowing her down swiftly onto the land. Nicholas felt suddenly exhausted to his bones. He lay flat on the deck, closed his eyes, and clung weakly to the severed cable. The wind wanted to hurl him over the side. It ballooned his oilskins and ripped at his face. It would be so easy to open his fingers and to let go, and it took all his resolve to resist the impulse. Slowly, as painfully as a crippled insect, he dragged himself back through the open, shattered doorway into the central passageway of the stern quarters. But still, the wind followed him. It roared down the passageway, driving in torrents of rain and salt water that flooded the deck and forced Nicholas to cling for support like a drunkard. After the open storm, the car of the elevator seemed silent and tranquil as the inner sanctum of a cathedral. He looked at himself in the wall mirror and saw that his eyes were scoured red and painful-looking by salt and wind, and his cheeks and lips looked raw and bruised as though the skin had been rasped away. He touched his face, and there was no feeling in his nose nor in his lips. The elevator door slid open, and he reeled out onto the navigation bridge. The group of men at the chart table seemed not to have moved, but their heads turned to him. Nicholas reached the table and clung to it. They were silent, watching his face. "I lost a man," he said, and his voice was hoarse and roughened by salt and weariness. "He went overboard. The wind got him." Still, none of them moved nor spoke. and Nicholas coughed. His lungs ached from the water he had breathed. When the spasm passed, he went on. The tow cable has parted. We are loose, and Warlock will never be able to re-establish tow. Not in this. All their heads turned now to the forward bridge windows, to that impenetrable racing whiteness beyond the glass that was lit internally with its glowing bursts of lightning. Nicholas broke the spell that held them all. He reached up to the signal locker above the chart table and brought down a cardboard packet of distress flares. He broke open the seals and spilled the flares onto the table. They looked like sticks of dynamite, the cylinders of heavily varnished waterproof paper. The flares could be lit and would spurt out crimson flames, even if immersed in water, once the self-ignited tab at one end was pulled. Nicholas stuffed half a dozen of the flares into the inner pockets of his oilskins. "Listen," he had to shout, even though they were only feet away. "We're going to be aground within 2 hours. This ship is going to start breaking up immediately we strike." He paused and studied their faces. Duncan was the only one who did not seem to understand. He had picked up a handful of the signal flares from the table and was looking inquiringly at Nicholas. "I will give you the word. As soon as we reach the 20-fathom line and she touches bottom, you will go over the side. We will try to get a raft away. There's a chance you can be carried ashore." He paused again, and he could see that Randall and his two seamen realized clearly just how remote that chance was. "I'll give you 20 minutes to get clear. By then, the pod tanks will have begun breaking up." He didn't want this to sound melodramatic, and he searched for some way to make it sound less theatrical, but could think of none. "Once the first tank ruptures, I will ignite the escaping crude with a signal flare." "Christ!" Randall mouthed the blasphemy, and the storm censored it on his lips. Then he raised his voice. "A million tons of crude. It will fireball, man. Better than a million-ton slick down the Gulf Stream," Nicholas told him wearily. "None of us will have a chance. 1 million tons. It'll go up like an atom bomb." Randall was white-faced and shaking now. "You can't do it." "Think of a better way," said Nicholas, and left the table to stagger across to the radio room. They watched him go. And then Duncan looked down at the signal flares in his hand for a moment before thrusting them into the pocket of his jacket. In the radio room, Nicholas called quietly into the microphone, "Come in, Sea Witch. Sea Witch, this is Golden Dawn." And only the static howled in reply. "Warlock, come in, Warlock. This is Golden Dawn." Something else went in the wind. They heard it tear loose, and the whole superstructure shook and trembled. The ship was beginning to break up. It had not been designed to withstand winds like this. Through the open radio room door, Nicholas could see the control console display. There were 71 fathoms of water under the ship, and the wind was punching her, flogging her on towards the shore. "Come in, Sea Witch," Nicholas called with quiet desperation. "This is Golden Dawn. Do you read me?" The wind charged the ship, crashing into it like a monster, and she groaned and reeled from the blow. "Come in, Warlock." Randall lurched across to the forward windows, and clinging to the rail, he bowed over the gauges that monitored the condition of the ship's cargo, checking for tank damage. "At least he's still thinking." Nicholas watched him, and above the captain's head, like sounding showed 68 fathoms. Randall straightened, slowly began to turn, and the wind struck again. Nicholas felt the blow in his stomach. It was a solid thing, like a mountain in avalanche, a deafening boom of sound, and the forward bridge window above the control console broke inwards. It burst in a glittering explosion of glass shards that engulfed the figure of Captain Randall, standing directly before it. In a fleeting moment of horror, Nicholas saw his head half severed from his shoulders by a guillotine of flying glass. Then he crumpled to the deck, and instantly the bright, pulsing hose of his blood was diluted to spreading pale pink in the torrent of wind and blown water that poured in through the opening and smothered the navigation bridge. Charts and books were ripped from their shelves and fluttered like trapped birds as the wind blustered and swirled in the confines of the glass and steel. Nicholas reached the captain's body, protecting his own face with an arm crooked across it. But there was nothing he could do for him. He left Randall lying on the deck and shouted to the others, "Keep clear of the windows!" He gathered them in the rear of the bridge, against the bulkhead where stood the decker and navigation systems. The four of them kept close together, as though they gained comfort from the close proximity of other humans. But the wind did not relent. It poured in through the shattered window and raged about the bridge, tearing at their clothing and filling the air with a fine mist of water, flooding the deck ankle deep so that it sloshed and ran as the tanker rolled almost to her beam ends. Randall's limp and sodden body slid back and forth in the wash and roll, until Nicholas left the dubious security of the after bulkhead, half lifted the corpse under the arms, and dragged it into the radio room, and wedged it into the radio operator's bunk. Swift blood stained the crisply ironed sheets, and Nicholas threw a fold of the blanket over Randall and staggered back into the bridge. Still the wind rose, and now Nicholas felt himself numbed by the force and persistence of it. Some loose material, perhaps a sheet of aluminium from the superstructure, or a length of piping ripped from the tank deck below, smashed into the top of the bridge like a cannonball, and then flipped away into the storm, leaving a jagged rent which the wind exploited, tearing and worrying at it, enlarging the opening, so that the plating flapped and hammered, and a solid deluge of rain poured in through it. Nicholas realized that the ship's superstructure was beginning to go. Like a gigantic vulture, soon the wind would begin stripping the carcass down to its bones. He knew he should get the survivors down nearer the waterline, so that when they were forced to commit themselves to the sea, they could do so quickly. But his brain was numbed by the tumult, and he stood stolidly. It needed all his remaining strength merely to brace himself against the tearing wind and the ship's anguished motion. In the days of sail, the crew would tie themselves to the mainmast when they reached this stage of despair. Dully, he registered that the depth of water under the ship was now only 57 fathoms, and the barometer was reading 955 millibars. Nicholas had never heard of a reading that low. Surely it could not go lower. They must be almost at the center of the revolving hurricane. With an effort, he lifted his arm and read the time. It was still only 10 o'clock in the morning. They had been in the hurricane for only 2.5 hours. A great burning light struck through the torn roof, a light that blinded them with its intensity, and Nicholas threw up his hands to protect his eyes. He could not understand what was happening. He thought his hearing had gone, for suddenly the terrible tumult of the wind was muted, fading away. Then he understood. The eye. He croaked. We are into the eye. And his voice resounded strangely in his own ears. He stumbled to the front of the bridge. Although the golden dawn still rolled ponderously, describing an arc of almost 40 degrees from side to side, she was free of the unbearable weight of the wind, and brilliant sunshine poured down upon her. It beamed down like the dazzling arc lamps of a stage set, out of the throat of a dark funnel of dense, racing, swirling cloud. The cloud lay to the very surface of the sea and encompassed the full sweep of the horizon in an unbroken wall. Only directly overhead was it open, and the sky was an angry, unnatural purple, set with the glaring, merciless eye of the sun. The sea was still wild and confused, leaping into peaks and troughs and covered with a thick, frothy mattress of spindrift, whipped into a custard by the wild winds. But already the sea was subsiding in the total calm of the eye, and golden dawn was rolling less viciously. Nicholas turned his head stiffly to watch the receding wall of racing cloud. How long would it take for the eye to pass over them, he wondered. Not very long, he was sure of that. Half an hour, perhaps, an hour at the most, and then the storm would be on them again, with its renewed fury every bit as sudden as its passing. But this time, the wind would come from exactly the opposite direction as they crossed the hub and went into the far side of the revolving wall of cloud. Nicholas jerked his eyes away from that racing, heaven-high bank of cloud and looked down onto the tank deck. He saw, at a single glance, that Golden Dawn had already sustained mortal damage. The forward port pod tank was half torn from its hydraulic coupling, holding only by the bows and lying at almost 20 degrees from the line of the other three tanks. The entire tank deck was twisted like the limb of an arthritic giant. It rolled and pitched out of sequence with the rest of the hull. Golden Dawn's back was broken. It had broken where Duncan had weakened the hull to save steel. Only the buoyancy of the crude petroleum in her four tanks was holding her together now. Nicholas expected to see the dark, glistening ooze of slick leaking from her. He could not believe that not one of the four tanks had ruptured, and he glanced at the electronic cargo monitor. Loads and gas contents of all tanks were still normal. They had been freakishly lucky so far, but when they went into the far side of the hurricane, he knew that Golden Dawn's weakened spine would give completely, and when that happened, it must pinch and tear the thin skins of the pod tanks. He made a decision then, forcing his mind to work, not certain how good a decision it was, but determined to act on it. Duncan, he called to him across the swamped and battered bridge. I'm sending you and the others off on one of the life rafts. This will be your only chance to launch one. I'll stay on board to fire the cargo when the storm hits again. The storm has passed. Suddenly Duncan was screaming at him like a madman. The ship is safe now. You're going to destroy my ship. You're deliberately trying to break me. He was lunging across the heaving bridge. It's deliberate. You know I've won now. You're going to destroy the ship. It's the only way you can stop me now. He swung a clumsy round arm blow. Nicholas ducked under it and caught Duncan around the chest. Listen to me, he shouted, trying to calm him. This is only the eye. You'd do anything to stop me. You swore you would stop me. Help me. Nicholas called to the two seamen, and they grabbed Duncan's arms. He bucked and fought like a madman, screaming wildly at Nicholas, his face contorted and swollen with rage, sodden hair flopping into his eyes. "You'd do anything to destroy me, to destroy my ship!" "Take him down to the raft deck," Nicholas ordered the two seamen. He knew he could not reason with Duncan now, and he turned away and stiffened suddenly. "Wait." He stopped them leaving the bridge. Nicholas felt the terrible burden of weariness and despair slip from his shoulders, felt new strength rippling through his body, recharging his courage and his resolution. For a mile away, from behind that receding wall of dreadful gray cloud, Sea Witch burst abruptly into the sunlight, tearing bravely along the water with water bursting over her bows and flying back as high as her bridgework, running without regard to the hazard of sea and storms. "Jules," Nicholas whispered. Jules was driving her like only a tugman can drive a ship, racing to beat the far wall of the storm. Nicholas felt his throat constricting, and suddenly the scalding tears of relief and thankfulness half blinded him. For a mile out on Sea Witch's port side, and barely a cable length astern of her, Warlock came crashing out of the storm bank, running every bit as hard as her sister ship. "David," Nicholas spoke aloud. "You too, David." He realized only then that they must have been in radar contact with him through those wild, tempestuous hours of storm passage, hovering there, holding station on Golden Dawn's crippled bulk and waiting for their first opportunity. Above the wail and crackle of static from the overhead loudspeaker boomed Jules Levoisin's voice. He was close enough, and in the clear eye, the interference allowed a readable radio contact. "Golden Dawn, this is Sea Witch. Come in, Golden Dawn." Nicholas reached the radio bench and snatched up the microphone. "Jules." He did not waste a moment in greeting or congratulations. "We are going to take the tanks off her and let the hull go. You understand?" "I understand to take off the tanks," Jules responded immediately. Nicholas's brain was crisp and clear again. He could see just how it must be done. "Warlock takes off the port tanks first, in tandem." In tandem, the two tanks would be strung like beads on a string. They have been designed to tow that way. "Then you will take off the starboard side."
"You must save the hull."
Duncan still fought the two seamen who held him.
"God damn you, Berg. I'll not let you destroy me."
Nicholas ignored his ravings until he had finished giving his orders to the two tugmasters. Then he dropped the microphone and grabbed Duncan by the shoulders. Nicholas seemed to be possessed suddenly by supernatural strength, and he shook him as though he were a child. He shook him so his head snapped back and forth and his teeth rattled in his head.
"You bloody idiot," he shouted in Duncan's face. "Don't you understand the storm will resume again in minutes?"
He jerked Duncan's body out of the grip of the two seamen and dragged him bodily to the windows overlooking the tank deck.
"Can't you see this monster you have built is finished? Finished! There is no propeller. Her back is broken. The superstructure will go minutes after the wind hits it again."
He dragged Duncan round to face him. Their eyes were inches apart.
"It's over, Duncan. We'll be lucky to get away with our lives. We'll be luckier still to save the cargo." "You don't understand. We've got to save the hull. Without it..."
Duncan started to struggle. He was a powerful man, and quickly he was rousing himself. Within minutes, he would be dangerous. And there was no time. Already Warlock was swinging up into her position on Golden Dawn's port beam for tank transfer.
"I'll not let you take off..."
Duncan wrenched himself out of Nicholas's grip. There was a mad, fanatic light in his eyes. Nicholas swiveled. Coming up onto his toes and swinging from the shoulders, he aimed for the point of Duncan's jaw, just below the ear, and the thick, sodden wedge of Duncan's red-gold sideburns. But Duncan rolled his head with the punch, and the blow glanced off his temple, and Golden Dawn rolled back the other way as Nicholas was unbalanced. He fell back against the control console, and Duncan drove at him, two running paces like a quarterback taking a field goal, and he kicked right-legged for Nicholas's lower body. "I'll kill you, Berg!" he screamed. And Nicholas had only time to roll sideways and lift his leg, scissoring it to protect his crotch. Duncan's kick caught him in the upper thigh. An explosion of white pain shot up into his belly and numbed his leg to the thigh. But he used the control console and his good leg to launch himself into a counterpunch, hooking with his right again, under the ribs. And the wind went out of Duncan's lungs with a whoosh as he doubled. Nicholas transferred weight smoothly and swung his left fist up into Duncan's face. It sounded like a watermelon dropped on a concrete floor, and Duncan was hurled backwards against the bulkhead, pinned there for a moment by the ship's roll. Nicholas followed him, hobbling painfully on the injured leg, and he hit him twice more, left and right, short, hard, hissing blows that cracked his skull backwards against the bulkhead and brought quick, bright rosettes of blood from his lips and nostrils. As his legs buckled, Nicholas caught him by the throat with his left hand and held him upright, searching his eyes for further resistance, ready to hit him again. But there was no fight left in him. Nicholas let him go and went to the signal locker. He snatched three of the small walkie-talkie radios from the radio shelves and handed one to each of the seamen. "You know the pod tank undocking procedures for a tandem tow?" he asked. "We've practiced it," one of them replied. "Let's go," said Nicholas. It was a job that was scheduled for a dozen men, and there were three of them. Duncan was of no use to them, and Nicholas left him in the pump control room on the lowest deck of Golden Dawn's stern quarter, after he had closed down the inert gas pumps, sealed the gas vents, and armed the hydraulic releases of the pod tanks for undocking. They worked sometimes neck deep in the bursts of green, frothing water that poured over the ultra-tanker's foredeck. They took on board and secured Warlock's main cable, unlocked the hydraulic clamps that held the forward pod tank attached to the hull. And as David Allen eased it clear of the crippled hull, they turned and lumbered back along the twisted and wind-torn catwalk, handicapped by the heavy sea boots and oilskins and the confused seas that still swamped the tank deck every few minutes. On the after tank, the whole laborious, energy-sapping procedure had to be repeated. But here it was complicated by the chain coupling, which connected the two half-mile-long pod tanks. Over the walkie-talkie, Nicholas had to coordinate the efforts of his seamen to those of David Allen at the helm of Warlock. When at last Warlock threw on power to both of her big propellers and sheered away from the wallowing hull, she had both port-barred tanks in tow. They floated just level with the surface of the sea, offering no windage for the hurricane winds that would soon be upon them again. Hanging onto the rail of the raised catwalk, Nicholas watched for 2 precious minutes with an appraising professional eye. It was an incredible sight. 2 great shiny black whales, their backs showing only in the troughs, and the gallant little ship leading them away. They followed meekly, and Nicholas's anxiety was lessened. He was not confident, not even satisfied, for there was still a hurricane to navigate, but There was hope now. Sea Witch, he spoke into the small portable radio. Are you ready to take on tow? Jules Le Voisin fired the rocket line across personally. Nicholas recognized his portly but nimble figure high in the fire control tower. And the rocket left a thin trail of snaking white smoke high against the backdrop of racing gray hurricane clouds. Arching high over the tanker's tank deck, the thin nylon rocket line fell over the catwalk 10 feet from where Nicholas stood. They worked with a kind of restrained frenzy, and Jules Le Voisin brought the big, graceful tug in so close beside them that, glancing up, Nicholas could see the flash of gold filling in Jules' white smile of encouragement. It was only a glance that Nicholas allowed himself, and then he raised his face and looked at the storm. The wall of cloud was slippery and smooth and grey, like the body of a gigantic slug, and at its foot trailed a glistening, white, slimy line where the winds frothed to the surface of the sea. It was very close now, 10 miles, no more, and above them the sun had gone, cut out by the spiralling vortex of leaden cloud. Yet still that opened, narrow funnel of clear, calm air reached right up to a dark and ominous sky. There was no hydraulic pressure on the clamps of the starboard forward pod tank. Somewhere in the twisted, damaged hull, the hydraulic line must have sheared. Nicholas and one of the seamen had to work the emergency release, pumping it open slowly and laboriously by hand. Still, it would not release. The hull was distorted, the clamp jaws out of alignment. "Pull!" Nicholas commanded Jules in desperation. "Pull all together!" The storm front was 5 miles away, and already he could hear the deadly whisper of the wind, and a cold puff touched Nicholas's uplifted face. The sea boiled under Sea Witch's counter, spewing out in a swift white wake as Jules brought in both engines. The tow cable came up hard and straight. For half a minute, nothing gave. Nothing moved, except the wall of racing grey cloud bearing down upon them. Then, with a resounding metallic clang, the clamp slipped, and the tank slid ponderously out of its dock in Golden Dawn's hull. As it came free, so the hull, held together until that moment by the tank's bulk and buoyancy, began to collapse. The catwalk on which Nicholas stood began to twist and tilt so that he had to grab for a handhold. And he stood frozen in horrified fascination as he watched Golden Dawn begin the final breakup. The whole tank deck, now only a gutted skeleton, began to bend at its weakened center, began to hinge like an enormous pair of nutcrackers, and caught between the jaws of the nutcracker was the starboard afterpod tank. It was a nut, the size of Chartres Cathedral, with a soft, liquid center, and a shell as thin as the span of a man's hand. Nicholas broke into a lurching, blundering run down the twisting, tilting catwalk, calling urgently into the radio as he went. "Sheer!" he shouted to the seaman, almost half a mile away across that undulating plain of tortured steel. "Sheer the tandem tow!" For the two starboard pod tanks were linked by the heavy chain of the tandem, and the forward tank was linked to Sea Witch by the main tow cable. So Sea Witch and the doomed Golden Dawn were coupled inexorably, unless they could cut the two tanks apart and let Sea Witch escape with the forward tank which she'd just undocked. The sheer control was in the control box halfway back along the tank deck. At that moment, the nearest seaman was 200 yards from it. Nicholas could see him staggering wildly back along the twisting, juddering catwalk. Clearly he realized the danger. But his haste was fatal. For as he jumped from the catwalk, the deck opened under him, gaping open like the jaws of a steel monster, and the seaman fell through, waist deep, into the opening between two moving plates. Then, as he squirmed feebly, the next lurch of the ship's hull closed the plates, sliding them across each other like the blades of a pair of scissors. The man shrieked once, and a wave burst over the deck, smothering his mutilated body in cold green water. When it poured back over the ship's side, there was no sign of the man. The deck was washed glisteningly clean. Nicholas reached the same point on the deck, judged the gaping and closing movement of the steel plate, and the next rush of sea coming on board, before he leapt across the deadly gap. He reached the control box and slid back the hatch, pressing himself into the tiny steel cubicle as he unlocked the red lid that housed the shear button. He hit the button with the heel of his hand. The four heavy chains of the tandem tow lay between the electrodes of the shear mechanism. With a gross surge of power from the ship's generators and a flash of blue electric flame, the thick steel links sheared as cleanly as cheese under the cutting wire. And half a mile away, Sea Witch felt the release and pounded ahead under the full thrust of her propellers, taking with her the forward starboard tank still held on main tow. Nicholas paused in the opening of the control cubicle, hanging on to the sill for support, and stared down at the single remaining tank, still caught inextricably in the tangled, moving forest of Golden Dawn's twisting, contorting hull. It was as though an invisible giant had taken the Eiffel Tower at each end and was bending it across his knee. Suddenly, there was a sharp chemical stink in the air, and Nicholas gagged on it. The stink of crude petroleum oil gushing from the ruptured tank. "Nicholas! Nicholas!" The radio set slung over his shoulder squawked, and he lifted it to his lips without taking his eyes from the Golden Dawn's terrible death throes. "Go ahead, Jules." "Nicholas, I'm turning back to pick you up." "You can't turn, not with that tow. I will put my bows against the starboard quarter-deck rail, directly under the forward wing of the bridge. Be ready to jump aboard." "Jules, you're out of your head. I've been that way for 50 years. Jules agreed amiably. "Be ready." "Jules, drop your tow first," Nicholas pleaded. It would be almost impossible to maneuver the Sea Witch with that monstrous dead weight hanging onto her tail. "Drop tow. We can pick it up again later." "You teach your grandfather to break eggs." Jules blithely mangled the old saying, giving it a sinister twist. "Listen, Jules, the number 4 tank has ruptured. I want you to shut down for fire. Do you understand? Full fire shutdown. Once I'm aboard, we'll put a rocket into her and burn off cargo." "I hear you, Nicholas, but I wish I had not." Nicholas left the control cubicle, jumped the gaping, chewing gap in the decking, and scrambled up the steel ladder onto the central catwalk. Glancing over his shoulder, he could see the endlessly slippery grey wall of racing cloud and wind. Its menace was overpowering, so that for a moment he faltered before forcing himself into running back along the catwalk towards the tanker's stern tower half a mile ahead. The single remaining seaman was on the catwalk 100 yards ahead of him, pounding determinedly back towards the pickup point. He'd also heard Jules Levoisin's last transmission. A quarter of a mile across the roiling, leaping waters, Jules Levoisin was bringing Sea Witch around. At another time, Nicholas would have been impressed by the consummate skill with which the little Frenchman was handling his ship with its burdensome tow. But now, there was time and energy for one thing only. The air stank. The heavy fumes of crude oil burned Nicholas's pumping lungs and constricted his throat. He coughed and gasped as he ran. The taste and reek of it coated his tongue and seared his nostrils. Below the catwalk, the bloated pod tank was punctured in 100 places by steel lances of the disintegrating hull. Pinched and torn by moving steel girders, and the dark red oil spurted and dribbled and oozed from it like the poisonous blood from the carcass of a mortally wounded dragon. Nicholas reached the stern tower, barged in through the storm doors to the lowest deck, and reached the pump control room. Duncan Alexander turned to him as he entered, his face swollen and bruised where Nicholas had beaten him. "We're abandoning now," said Nicholas. "Sea Witch is taking us off." "I hated you from that very first day." Duncan was very calm, very controlled, his voice even, deep, and cultured. "Did you know that?" "There's no time for that now." Nicholas grabbed his arm, and Duncan followed him readily into the passageway. "That's what the game is all about, isn't it, Nicholas? Power and wealth and women. That's the game we played." Nicholas was barely listening. They were out onto the quarterdeck, standing at its starboard rail below the bridge, the pickup point that Jules had stipulated. Sea Witch was turning in, only 500 yards out, and Nicholas had time now to watch Jules handle his ship. He was running out the heavy tow cable on free spool, deliberately letting a long bite of it form between the tug and its enormous whale-like burden. And he was using the slack in the cable to cut in towards Golden Dawn's battered, sagging hulk. He would be alongside for the pickup in less than a minute. "That was the game we played, you and I." Duncan was still talking calmly. "Power and wealth and women." Below them, Golden Dawn poured her substance into the sea in a slick, stinking flood. The waves, battering against her side, churned the oil to a thick, filthy emulsion, and it was spreading away across the surface, bleeding its deadly poison into the Gulf Stream to broadcast it to the entire ocean. "I won," Duncan went on reasonably. "I won it all. Every time." He was groping in his pockets, but Nicholas hardly heard him, was not watching him. "Until now." Duncan took one of the self-igniting signal flares from his pocket and held it against his chest with both hands, slipping his index finger through the metal ring of the igniter tab. "And yet, I win this one also, Nicholas," he said. "Game, set, and match." And he pulled the tab on the flare with a sharp jerk and stepped back, holding it aloft. It spluttered once and then burst into brilliant, sparkling red flame, white phosphorescent smoke billowing from it. Now at last, Nicholas turned to face him, and for a moment he was too appalled to move. Then he lunged for Duncan's raised hand that held the burning flare, but Duncan was too fast for him to reach it. He whirled and threw the flame in a high, spluttering arc out over the leaking, stinking tank deck. It struck the steel tank and bounced once, and then rolled down the canted, oil-coated plating. Nicholas stood paralyzed at the rail, staring down at it. He expected a violent explosion, but nothing happened. The flare rolled innocently across the deck, burning with its pretty red twinkling light. "It's not burning," Duncan cried. "Why doesn't it burn?" Of course, The gas was only explosive in a confined space, and it needed spark. Out here in the open air, the oil had a very high flash point. It must be heated to release its volatiles. The flare caught in the scuppers, spluttered and fizzled in a black pool of Croid, and only then the crude caught. It caught with a red, slow, sulky flame that spread quickly but not explosively over the entire deck. And instantly, thick billows of dark smoke rose in a dense, choking cloud. Below where Nicholas stood, the Sea Witch thrust her bows in and touched them against the tanker's side. The seaman beside Nicholas jumped and landed neatly on the tug's bows, then raced back along Sea Witch's deck. "Nicholas!" Jules' voice thundered over the loud hailer. "Jump, Nicholas!" Nicholas spun back to the rail and poised himself to jump. Duncan caught him from behind, whipping one arm around his throat and pulling him backwards away from the rail. "No," Duncan shouted. "You're staying, my friend. You are not going anywhere. You're staying here with me." A greasy wave of black, choking smoke engulfed them, and Jules' magnified voice roared in Nicholas's ears. "Nicholas, I cannot hold her here. Jump, quickly, jump!" Duncan had him off balance, dragging him backwards, away from the ship's side, and suddenly Nicholas knew what he must do. Instead of resisting Duncan's arm, he hurled himself backwards, and they crashed together into the superstructure. But Duncan bore the combined weight of both their bodies. His arm lock around the throat relaxed slightly, and Nicholas drove his elbow into Duncan's side below the ribs, then wrenched his body forward from the waist, reached between his own braced legs, and caught Duncan's ankles. He straightened up again, dragging Duncan off his feet, and the same instant dropped backwards with his full weight onto the deck. Duncan gasped, and his arm fell away, as Nicholas bounced to his feet again, choking in the greasy billows of smoke, and he reached the ship's side. Below him, the gap between Sea Witch's bows and the tanker's side was rapidly widening, and the thrust of the sea and the drag of the tug tow pulled them apart. Nicholas vaulted onto the rail, poised for a moment, and then jumped. He struck the deck and his teeth cracked together with the impact. His injured leg gave under him, and he rolled once. Then he was up on his hands and knees. He looked up at Golden Dawn. She was completely enveloped now in the boiling column of black smoke. As the flames heated the leaking crude, so it burned more readily. The bank of smoke was shot through now with the satanic crimson of high, hot flame. As Sea Witch sheered desperately away, the first rush of the storm hit them, and for a moment it smeared the smoke away, exposing the tanker's high quarterdeck. Duncan Alexander stood at the rail above the roaring holocaust of the tank deck. He stood with his arms extended, and he was burning. His clothing burned fiercely, and his hair was a bright torch of flame. He stood like a ritual cross, outlined in fire. And then slowly, he seemed to shrivel, and he toppled forwards over the rail into the bubbling, spurting, burning cargo of the monstrous ship that he had built. And the black smoke closed over him like a funeral cloak. As the crude oil escaping from the pierced pod tank fed the flames, so the heat built up swiftly, still sufficient to consume only the volatile aromatic spirits, which constituted less than half the bulk of the cargo. The heavy carbon elements, not yet hot enough to burn, boiled off in that solid black column of smoke. And as the returning winds of the hurricane raced over the golden dawn once more, so that filthy pall was mixed with air and lifted into the cloud bank of the storm, rising first 1,000, then 10, then 20,000 feet above the surface of the ocean. And still golden dawn burned, and the temperatures of the gas and oil mixture trapped in her hull rocketed steeply. Steel glowed red, then brilliant white, ran like molten wax, and then like water. And suddenly, the flash point of heavy carbon smoke in a mixture of air and water vapor was reached in the womb of this mighty furnace. Golden Dawn and her entire cargo turned into a fireball. The steel and glass and metal of her hull disappeared in an instantaneous explosive combustion that released temperatures like those upon the surface of the sun. Her cargo, 250,000 tons of it, burned in an instant, releasing a white, blooming rose of pure heat so fierce that it shot up into the upper stratosphere and consumed the billowing pall of its own hydrocarbon gas and smoke. The very air burst into flame. The surface of the sea flamed in that white fireball of heat, and even the clouds of smoke burned as the oxygen and hydrocarbon they contained exploded. Once an entire city had been subjected to this phenomena of fireball. When stone and earth and air had exploded, and 5,000 German citizens of the city of Cologne had been vaporized, and that vapor burned in the heat of its own release. But this fireball was spawned by 250,000 tons of volatile liquids. "Can't you get us further away?" Nicholas shouted above the thunder of the hurricane. His mouth was only inches from Jules Levoisin's ear. They were standing side by side, hanging from the overhead railing that gave purchase on this wildly pitching deck.
"If I open the taps, I will part the tow wire," Jules shouted back.
Sea Witch was alternately standing on her nose and then her tail. There was no forward view from the bridge, only green washes of seawater and banks of spray. The full force of the hurricane was on them once more, and a glance at the radar scope showed the glowing image of Golden Dawn's crippled and bleeding hull only 0.5 mile astern. Suddenly, the glass of the windows was obscured by an impenetrable blackness, and the light in Sea Witch's navigation bridge was reduced to only the glow of her firelights and the electronic instruments and her control console. Jules Levoisin turned his face to Nicholas, his plump features haunted by green shadows in the gloom.
"Smoke bank," Nicholas shouted an explanation. There was no reek of the filthy hydrocarbon in the bridge, for Sea Witch was shut down for fire drill, all her ports and ventilators sealed, her internal air conditioning on a closed circuit, the air being scrubbed and recharged with oxygen by the big carrier unit above the main engine room. "We are directly downwind of the Golden Dawn." A fierce rush of the hurricane winds laid Sea Witch over on her side, the lee rail deep under the racing green sea, and held her there, unable to rise against the careless might of the storm for many minutes. Her crew hung desperately from any handhold, the irksome burden of her tow helping to drag her down further. The propellers found no grip in the air, and her engines screamed in anguish. But Sea Witch had been built to live in any sea,
and the moment the wind hesitated, she fought off the water that had come aboard and began to swing back. "Where is Warlock?" Jules bellowed anxiously. The danger of collision preyed upon him constantly. Two ships and their elephantine tows, manoeuvring closely in confined hurricane waters, was nightmare on top of nightmare. 10 miles east of us. Nicholas picked the other tug's image out of the trash of the radarscope. They had a start, ahead of the wind. He would have gone on, but the boiling bank of hydrocarbon smoke that surrounded Sea Witch turned to fierce white light, a light that blinded every man on the bridge as though a photograph flashlight had fired in his face. "Fireball!" Nicholas shouted, and completely blinded, reached for the remote controls of the water cannons 70 feet above the bridge on Sea Witch's fire control tower. Minutes before, he had aligned the 4 water cannons, training them down at their maximum angle of depression. So now, as he locked down the multiple triggers, Sea Witch deluged herself in a pounding cascade of seawater. Sea Witch was caught in a furnace of burning air, and despite the torrents of water she spewed over herself, her paintwork was burned away in instantaneous combustion so fierce that it consumed its own smoke, and almost instantly the bare, scorched metal of her exposed upperworks began to glow with heat. The heat was so savage that it struck through the insulated hull, through the double glazing of the 2-inch armored glass of her bridge windows, scorching and frizzling away Nicholas's eyelashes and blistering his lips as he lifted his face to it. The glass of the bridge windows wavered and swam as they began to melt. And then abruptly, there was no more oxygen. The fireball had extinguished itself, consumed everything in its 20 seconds of life, everything from sea level to 30,000 feet above it, a brief and devastating orgasm of destruction. It left a vacuum, a weak spot in the Earth's thin skin of air. It formed another low-pressure system, smaller but much more intense and more hungry to be filled than the eye of Hurricane Lorna itself. It literally tore the guts out of that great revolving storm, setting up counterwinds and a vortex within the established system that ripped it apart. New gales blew from every point about the fireball's vacuum, swiftly beginning their own dervish spirals, and 20 miles short of the mainland of Florida, Hurricane Lorna checked her mindless, blundering charge, fell in upon herself, and disintegrated into 50 different willy-nilly squalls and whirlpools of air that collided and split again, slowly degenerating into nothingness. On a morning in April, in Galveston Roads, the salvage tug Sea Witch dropped off tow to 4 smaller harbor tugs who would take the Golden Dawn No. 3 pod tank up the Narrows to the Orient Amex discharge installation below Houston. Her sister ship Warlock, Captain David Allen commanding, had dropped off his tandem tow of No. 1 and No. 2 pod tanks to the same tugs 48 hours previously. Between the two ships, they had made good salvage under Lloyd's open form of 750,000 tons of crude petroleum, valued at $85.50 US a ton. To the prize would be added the value of the 3 tanks themselves. Not less than $65 million, all told, Nicholas calculated. And he owned both ships and the full share of the salvage award. He had not sold to the sheikhs yet, though for every day of the tow from the Florida Straits to Texas, there had been frantic telex messages from James Teacher in London. The sheikhs were desperate to sign now, but Nicholas would let them wait a little longer. Nicholas stood on the open wing of Sea Witch's Bridge and watched the four smaller harbour tugs bustling importantly about their ungainly charge. He lifted the cheroot to his lips carefully, for they were still blistered from the heat of the fireball, and he pondered the question of how much he had achieved, apart from spectacular riches. He had reduced the spill from a million to a quarter of a million tons of cad-rich crude, and he had burned it in a fireball. Nevertheless, there had been losses. Toxins had been lifted high above the fireball. They had spread and settled across Florida as far as Tampa and Tallahassee, poisoning the pastures and killing thousands of head of domestic stock. But the American authorities had been quick to extend the hurricane emergency procedures. There had been no loss of human life. He had achieved that much. Now he had delivered the salvaged pod tanks to Orient Amex. The new cracking process would benefit all mankind, and nothing that Nicholas could do would prevent men carrying the cad-rich crudes of El Barras across the ocean. But would they do so in the same blindly irresponsible manner that Duncan Alexander had attempted? He knew then, with utter certainty, that it was his appointed life's work from now on to try and ensure that they did not. He knew how he was to embark upon that work. He had the wealth that was necessary, and Tom Parker had given him the other instruments to do the job. He knew, with equal certainty, who would be his companion in that life's work. And standing on the fire-scorched deck of the gallant little vessel, he had a vivid image of a golden girl who walked forever beside him in sunlight and in laughter. Samantha. He said her name aloud just once, and suddenly he was very eager to begin. And that's the end of Hungry as the Sea by Wilbur Smith.